Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom. Chapter 3. A Cowboy's Courtship. The younger generation of the little frontier cow town of Oogala was in a fever of excitement when Will Rogers arrived home after his travels in South Africa, the Antipodes, and the Orient. But the agitation was not occasioned by the return of the prodigal. No fatted calf was slaughtered in honor of his coming, for the meanderings of a cowboy were taken for granted, and for all it mattered, Will might just as well have been working in the neighboring county. The flurry was caused by a pretty girl with whom Will proceeded to fall in love at first sight, but he was too shy even to seek an introduction. She was Betty Blake, a young lady in her teens and the sister of the Oogala Depot agent. She had come to the little town on a visit from her home in Arkansas. The bicycle craze was just sweeping the country, and young Rogers was one of the first in his section to procure one. A born showman, he decided on a campaign to win the young lady's attention. Miss Blake was seated on her porch one day when Will came tearing down the dusty road on his new two-wheeler. He planned to show her some trick riding, just as he had seen cyclists perform in his travels. Something went wrong, for the trick ended in midair, and Will landed on his head. Betty rushed to his aid, and as she wiped the blood from a slight cut, he grinned and drawled, "Guess I better stick to cow ponies." That was the beginning, and thereafter the courtship was concluded in a rubber-tired buggy. In later years, Rogers always smilingly declared that he wore out a set of the tires driving Betty around trying to get her to say yes. At any rate, Betty left for her home in Rogers, Arkansas, where she became a schoolteacher, and Will went back trooping with a Wild West show, which he joined in Oklahoma. From there, he went on to big-time vaudeville, and with a comfortable salary assured, Rogers thought once more of the pretty girl he had left behind in the Southwest. The beauties he met along Broadway and in show business meant nothing to him. Rogers was part of the glamorous nightlife of New York's most brilliant period, but he did not belong to it. In November 1908, he hurried down to Arkansas, and there took the bride, who was to be his only partner and sweetheart through the years that he was climbing, from a cowhand vaudeville performer to a place in international fame. The ceremony was performed in the modest two-story frame house where the young schoolteacher made her home. "It was the luckiest thing that ever happened to me," Rogers frequently declared. "Betty is the blame for all of it. Whatever I am or have accomplished, I owe to Betty. I ain't got no sense. My wife made me what I am. In other words, local girl makes good in the city, makes good man." The perfect match. In the hurly-burly of the theatrical world, where divorce was common occurrence, the Rogers marriage was classed as the perfect match. Just before his death, Will commented on his stardom in the movies. "I'm not a real movie star. I still got the same wife I started out with nearly 28 years ago." And 3 days after his death, Mrs. Rogers received the last expression of his affection for her. It was a small package addressed to her at Beverly Hills, California. The name and address were written in the careless, rambling scrawl that was Will's typical handwriting. In the box was a small red fox fur, a souvenir of the country where he had met his end. It was sent from Juneau, Alaska, the first stop made by Rogers and Post on their tragic flight. From the day of their marriage, Mrs. Rogers, a tall, blonde, blue-eyed, and gracious woman, took charge of Will. She mothered his children and made home the dearest spot on earth to all of them, whether it was the extensive ranch at Santa Monica or their simple bungalow at Beverly Hills. Self-effacing and understanding, she never interfered with her husband's career, but undoubtedly she was the one guiding genius that did the most to help him along the path to greatness. A lesser character could have blighted the sturdy oak that was Will Rogers. "Betty," Will told cronies, "is my manager. I try to get in a few laughs and get some money and then let her do the rest. She is the financial end of the firm." When guests came to the home, Will always acted as if they had come to call on her rather than himself. "Oh, sometimes they come out to see me," he said proudly, "but when they go away, they remember only Betty." wife's judgment best. It was her judgment that Will trusted above all others. Whenever a new contract was to be signed, he never put a pen to the paper until he had first consulted his wife. He would stuff it into his pocket, according to Winfield Sheehan, his boss at the Fox Studios, with the remark, "You know, I've got to see someone about this." Will read her every word he wrote at home before sending it out for publication. If she failed to understand some reference to politics, he would change it because he reasoned that others might miss the point. If the writing was supposed to be humorous and it failed to amuse her, Will would throw it away and try again. He read all the newspapers in the town at breakfast and threw them on the floor as fast as he'd finished with them. He couldn't pack a grip and was certain to miss trains unless Mrs. Rogers bossed the job, and he always was late for meals except for breakfast. He was an early riser, getting along with 7 hours sleep or less. In an interview, Mrs. Rogers was once asked to describe Will at home. The result was a vivid picture of Will Rogers, the husband and father. "Is Will funny at home?" she said, repeating the first question put to her. "Of course he is. Will can't help being funny no matter where he happens to be. His humor isn't the artificial kind that you can put on and take off like a coat. He's just himself. He's always himself. He doesn't try to be funny. He just is." Rogers at home. But anyone who thinks that Will at home is constantly the entertainer is very much mistaken. He works hard, and much of his time is taken up by reading. When he comes home after a long or a short absence, we all rush to him, crowd about him. Everything is gay and joyous. But he isn't the type that slips into a dressing gown and slippers and relaxes. He's too busy for that, and much too active. When he isn't writing or reading or sleeping or eating, he's riding horseback with his children. Hero worship isn't one of his tendencies, and he is never particularly impressed by anybody. The statesmen and other great men he met, he judged simply as good, bad, or indifferent people. I don't mean that Will doesn't recognize greatness in people, but he doesn't change his own personality to suit others. Will's devotion to his wife and children was always the greatest thing in his life. They had three children, Will Jr., who was 23 when his father died, Mary, 2 years younger, and Jimmy, 2 years farther down the line. Another son, who died in infancy, was named Fred after Fred Stone, musical comedy star and one of Roger's best friends. Will was never cross with the children, and he never spanked them. "I had to take care of the spankings," Mrs. Rogers once said. Children, good riders. The Rogers children, before they could walk, were placed on a horse's back and taught to ride. In 1917, they caused considerable comment when they appeared on horseback at an outdoor show. "New Yorkers," wrote the New York Sun, "who went to the big benefit at the Polo Grounds last summer for the Sun Tobacco Fund, will remember the amazement the little tykes created when they came galloping out, yipping and sticking to the leather like regular cowmen. Their pa wasn't any prouder of them that day than he was every day, because whenever he thinks of, talks to, or sees those kids, he's just naturally thrown his pride into high and breaks all the speed laws on the statute books." Rogers himself wrote the captions for the pictures of his children that were taken at the time. They reveal Will's flair for writing succinct paragraphs with a touch of humor. At the same time, they show how proud he was of his youngsters. The captions follow. "Youngest cowboy in the world, Jim, age 2, and he can ride. If you want to start a civil war, just try to take him off that pony. He eats there. All mounted on their own ponies, the youngest cow terriers in the world, Bill, 6, and Mary, 4. Here we come, all in a dead run, and nobody holding on. They won't ride unless they can ride in a run. I'm riding the only opposition to a Ford. The Home Defense League on parade. The tough little bird on the end is not holding his gun right, but nonetheless has the nerve to tell him so. That's Roosevelt Rogers." The Rogers Ranch. Will loved every foot of his ranch because it gave him an opportunity to play and ride with his children. On the place, he kept more than 100 head of horses, many of them tough little polo ponies. The ranch was a tribute to his business sagacity. The first section of it cost $3,000 and represented his first investment in California real estate. When he died, the ranch was valued at more than $500,000. He had two polo fields in place and was credited with introducing the game to the movie colony. Rogers never stopped talking, even while playing a fast game of polo. When he was charging down on the ball with a cowboy yell, he was telling someone else how to smack the willow sphere. He rode hard and was in nearly every play. One of his favorite tricks was to crowd his opponent's horse and force the animal to veer away from the ball. Despite his age, he played a fearless game, and while he didn't have many spills, he was whacked in the face several times with a mallet while dashing into the play. One of the best polo teams on the ranch was composed of Will, his two sons, and Mary. They played some splendid games until Mary, as her father put it, left and went society on us. For the most part, however, Will kept his children in the background and refused to let them be exploited because of his fame. Once they showed the inclination to strike out in the world for themselves and prove their ability to take care of themselves, he sat proudly back and let them go ahead. They are not the kind of kids who want to get on by anything I may have done, he declared, and I won't let anyone exploit them simply because they're my kids. Mary seeks stage center. Mary's decision to seek a stage and screen career was, in her father's words, her own doings. When she was 19, she sought out David Butler, director, and B.G. DeSilva, Fox producer, when she heard they were casting for a musical comedy movie, and asked for a job. She introduced herself as Mary Blake and made a successful screen test. She was put to work before either they or her father discovered her little plot. Will was proud of her achievement, but he refused to help her with her career. However, he did not interfere when she went east to dramatic school and was happy at her success in the plays in which she had a part with summer stock companies. Mary continued to use her mother's name and went on with tedious process of learning to act by joining the Lake Players at Skowhegan, Maine, where she played two summer seasons. By a strange coincidence, she was playing the feminine lead in the aviation play Ceiling Zero when her father crashed in the Arctic. In the play, the leading man, father of the girl portrayed by Mary Rogers, was killed in an airplane crash. This was the climax of the play. A few days before the accident, Rogers sent the following telegram to his daughter as a word of encouragement. Since I wired you last year for the opening of the Lakewood Theater, I got up there and seen the place. It's awful pretty. You got no reason for not acting good there. Give all the actors and folks up there my love. Tell Mr. Burke, the director, not to take the play too seriously, as the Supreme Court is liable to rule it illegal anyhow. I expect there is quite a few Republicans showing their heads up this year. It's been one of the best seasons for them in 4 or 5 years. I will be up to see you, but not till the snow starts melting. Rogers attended Mary's debut as an actress in New York in the winter of 1934. As he described the play, it had a successful run on the stage of one consecutive week. He went backstage to congratulate her after the performance, and while waiting with Mrs. Rogers to go into her dressing room, a fireman passed by. "Now there's a job that must be a rather nice," Mrs. Rogers said. "Oh, I don't know," drawled Will. "He never gets to any fires, and think of all the actors he has to listen to." Proud of eldest son. Will was also proud of the fact that his eldest son, whom he called Bill, refused to trade on his father's name and was determined to make his own way in the newspaper business. Eventually, the young man told his father he hoped to buy and publish a country newspaper, the dream, incidentally, of every newspaper man since the discovery of printer's ink. Will teased the boy about it occasionally. "You couldn't ever write like your pappy, anyway," he told him. "Maybe not," replied Bill, "but when I get to be a publisher, I can hire plenty of men to do the writing." Will Rogers was always thinking about his children and worried about their safety when they were away from home. During the winter of 1933, a heavy downpour of rain washed out the road leading to the Roger Ranch. A deep gully made the road impassable, and motorists that crashed into it were certain to be killed. It was New Year's Eve, and the Rogers children were out at a party. Will saddled a horse and lighted a red lantern. With the water swishing on his horse's knees, Rogers patrolled the road near the chasm all night, warning motorists of the danger. He kept at his task with fear clutching at his heart, for he knew that if this one road were washed out, others were likely to be. Finally, young Bill came driving up and saw the red lantern swinging in the rain. Then he heard his father shout, "Hiya there, stop your car." When he saw his son, he shook hands with him and shouted, "Bill, I'm so glad you made it." Rogers never believed in investing money in stocks and bonds. He used to say, "I'll take mine in a good old Mother Earth. A feller can have some fun fixing a spot for himself and his family and his friends to enjoy in his life." Will, a tireless fixer. He was a tireless fixer, and the story is told of his remodeling of a home he once owned in Beverly Hills. He decided it was time that Mary had her own suite of bedroom, sitting room, and bath. A contractor was called in, and the plans were made. But every time Rogers came home, he wanted something changed. This room was moved, and that one torn down. The poor builder was in despair, and no one had any notion of what the place would be like if it was ever completed. Will solved the problem, after all, when he ordered, "Tear the whole blame thing down." At the Santa Monica Ranch home, Will was always making changes in the sprawling, rambling place with its great rooms and comfortable furniture. In the ranch house, he had private quarters for himself, including a room filled with souvenirs from all parts of the globe, all of them gifts from the great and near great whom he had met on his travels. One room was devoted entirely to Indian things, many of them priceless, for the Indians regarded Rogers as the greatest of men. The latest addition to the ranch was a two-room log cabin, half a mile away from the main house, and reached only by a rough bridled trail. This was Will's exclusive private haven. He had it decorated with Indian trappings in the gay color schemes that marked the old pueblos of the Southwest. On one occasion, Will was showing a visitor around the ranch. He pointed out some adjoining properties and said, "See those pretty white fences? Every one of them surrounds a mortgage." Restless around home. Around the house, he was restless, moving from chair to chair. He was always fiddling with something, and if lunch was late, he would pick up two forks and bang them for service. At one time or another, he bought a hurdy-gurdy piano, violin, banjo, drums, mandolin, and guitar. He could pick out a few chords on the guitar, but only because they had been pointed out to him, and he had laboriously learned them for a part in a show in which he was starred. He tried to pick out tunes on the others, but was successful only with the hurdy-gurdy. Nothing could be as eloquent and as revealing of his innate modesty as the incident that occurred when he took Mrs. Rogers for an automobile ride. They decided to stop at a motion picture theater. Before reaching the box office, Will discovered he had no money with him. Mrs. Rogers' handbag, likewise, was empty. "Let's go home, Betty," he said. And they did. It apparently never occurred to him that he need only appear at any theater in the United States and a good part of Europe besides to be given immediate entrance without stopping for a ticket. Not only that, but one of his pictures was being shown on the screen of the theater that he had wanted to attend.